In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Whenever you hear about things like election integrity or voter fraud in the alleged media, what used to be the mainstream media, they will go out of their way to paint anyone who dares to question the elections as election deniers. Unless you're Hillary Clinton or a Democrat in 2016. And while today's show is about election integrity, it's not about being an election denier. It is entirely about being an election confirmer. What is so wrong, in the media's opinion, about wanting to be sure the results are correct, that they're based on fair elections, that they're not based on illegal votes being cast, that signatures matched, that the election was done fairly and honestly, that all of the safeguards that are allegedly in place are, in fact, working? Isn't it the media's job to question things? Keep in mind, those in government have plenty of incentives, trillions of them, to cheat, to keep themselves and their allies in government and in power. If you're not suspicious of them, something is not wrong with them, something is seriously wrong with you. Because on today's show, you're going to hear about some worrisome aspects of our elections and whether they really are honest, including a loophole that could open the door to illegal immigrants voting. Except that loophole isn't the worst of it. I would like to welcome Catherine Engelbrecht back to the show. She is the president of True the Vote. Their mission is to support trustworthy, free, and fair elections and to empower citizens in such lawful efforts. And you can find out more about them by heading to truethevote.org. Catherine, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So 2 weeks ago, you had an explosive interview with Tucker Carlson describing a potential loophole that True the Vote had found that could allow illegal aliens to vote in federal elections. And we'll get into that in just a bit. But before we do, Oregon's primary was this week, and we had some interesting results. Politico even picked up on it and reported that progressives flopped in Oregon. Even races for DA in very blue Multnomah County saw the more conservative candidate, well, if you can call him conservative in Multnomah County, beating out the George Soros incumbent. This matters for today's discussion because progressives tend to claim they want to make it easier to vote, but in reality, that means easier to cheat. Are you seeing this kind of trend in other states that maybe being extremely far left and progressive may not be going over so well this year?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that America has, and Americans have had enough. They've had their fill. We've seen how this administration's policies have played out, and those that they have catalyzed in their wake that spread out across the rest of the country. And I think Americans are saying, "What is happening here? Hmm. This has gone too far," and it's not a moment too soon. But I think it bodes well for the future of our country.
Well, I certainly hope so. And of course, you know, it is the primary, and you can't always judge how the general will turn out from the results of the primary. But it does give me a little bit of hope that, especially after a year of lawlessness at the southern border, that just maybe people are getting tired of it all, including all the lawfare against President Trump. If this is a trend, is there anything in particular that you would attribute it to?
I think it's a function of people, you know, sadly, in some respects, I guess, but in others, very positively, beginning to search out meaning outside of the, you know, propaganda machine that is mainstream media, and looking to try to really think through what they're being told versus what their own eyes tell them about what's happening in their community, what's happening in their children's schools, what's happening at the border, what's happening in healthcare. You mean the list goes on and on. And that has, I believe, just caused a chain reaction that is now playing out at the polls with people saying we just don't want any more part of it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of work yet to be done. Our process is still very vulnerable across many fronts, and it still can be exploited. But nothing can stop the American people if we stand together and engage.
You mentioned people are starting to have a revolt on this. I mean, look at places like Chicago that have had to suddenly actually be a sanctuary city like they've been claiming to all of these decades. And now you got citizens there that are just up in arms saying, why are we giving all of these resources to illegals rather than to our own communities that are still struggling? And you also mentioned work to be done. Speaking of that, since the new leadership took over, the RNC has had something like 85 lawsuits to clean up election problems in states. Are you starting to see any results yet in terms of some of these states being sued or other states improving their election integrity?
Well, I have seen other states beginning to work towards improvements in their process, which is, again, fabulous. We've seen, you know, states that have gotten rid of drop boxes. We've seen states that have doubled down on the right of citizens to challenge ineligible records. So there are and states that have tightened their standards around mass mail out of ballots and really try to reclaim some of the normal process that existed before COVID. You know, there's so many things that were ushered in the state of this emergency, and it was always supposed to be emergency, but then, you know, a wink and a nod later, it became part of the standard process. So many legislatures have done really solid work in dialing all of that back, which was very, very necessary. As far as all of the lawsuits, you know, many of them have only recently been filed, which is great, but it's still a little too soon to tell. I do, though, think it's a great sign that they are engaged.
Yeah.
This is something that we did not see in 2020. In 2020, this time of the year, True the Vote was actively filing lawsuits because the RNC simply wasn't.
Yeah.
And when we, you know, inquired about how this could be, because it was so clear that standards were being changed that were unconstitutional. At that time, the party line was just that they didn't get involved during primaries, which, of course, it had nothing to do with, the changes had nothing to do with whether it was a primary or the general. It had to do with the process and it being unconstitutional. So now they're going back and trying to clean some of that up. And it's a tall order, but I'm just happy to see that they're on the field, you know, defending what I believe to be the proper process.
Yes.
And, you know, that's what's needed.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so many of those safeguards back there in 2020, it was just shocking to sit there, even though not much of that happened here in Oregon because we already had mail-in ballots and whatnot, but it was shocking to see places like Pennsylvania obviously throwing out these rules that were safeguards. Where was the legislature at that point? It's like, do you not care about the laws that you pass, and now they're not even bothering to follow any of those? Well, speaking of courts, in the second half of today's show, we're going to be talking more about this, but I'd like your take on it. The U.S. Supreme Court just turned down hearing Oregon's election integrity case regarding dubious mail-in ballots. Are you frustrated by how some courts, especially the Supreme Court, seem to be unwilling to get involved in how states run elections, or do you feel it should be left to state legislatures without court interference?
You know, it's a toss-up. The problem I think that we have in so many respects, you know, certainly around mail ballots, but it's also, impacted through inaccurate voter rolls and lack of standard process during election day. And there's so many elements of the actual blocking and tackling of elections that just aren't as clear as they ought to be in state law, and it leaves so much wiggle room when you try to bring a case that oftentimes courts look at it and say, we can't, this is out of our ability to determine because the laws aren't written in such a way as to be meaningfully enforced. So that's it would be a healthy exercise for every state to sit down with leadership working at the elections and engaged citizens and talk about practical aspects of what works and what doesn't work on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because if you don't, then you end up with these kinds of cases where it's sort of like trying to nail down Jell-O. You just can't get to it.
Yeah, it's just utter chaos. Okay, it is time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with Catherine Engelbrick about that Tucker Carlson interview where she described a possible loophole that could allow illegal immigrants to vote without fear of punishment. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Catherine Engelbrecht, the president of True the Vote. Their mission is to support trustworthy, free, and fair elections, fighting in the trenches to protect the rights of eligible voters. And This is really why we wanted to have you on today, about protecting the rights of those eligible voters, because those rights are lost when ineligible voters cast ballots, and in particular, illegal immigrants potentially voting in the 2024 presidential election. And I mentioned that a couple weeks ago, you had that stunning revelation on the Tucker Carlson show that there's a potential legal loophole that may allow illegal citizens to vote in federal elections. So tell our audience about what you discovered.
Sure. You know, we had our fill with hearing leftist politicos just, you know, toss off any notion that non-citizens might vote, because, and you know, the standard line was always, well, it's just, it's illegal. It couldn't happen. It's illegal. But
well,
we know,
well, so is bank robbery.
Right. So is, you know, coming into the country without citizenship status. So it's, the whole thing's illegal.
Right.
But, you know, nonetheless, that was the talking point. And so we decided to do a bit of a deeper dive and really take a look at the laws that govern the process of alien voting and what that looked like as a practical matter. The process of how new applicants get registered and how easy it is for non-citizens to be registered to vote, and how difficult it is for states to separate non-citizens from citizens in the voter rolls and all of that. We knew that there was enough confusion to gum up any election. But looking back at the law was where the Tucker interview came from, because we looked at Title 18 of the U.S. Criminal Code, Section 611, which was initially passed in 1996 as a standard for what was they referred to as alien voting, and it lists out all the ways that things are illegal. But then in 2000, an amendment was passed. It was a three-part amendment, and it had to do the A, B, and C parts of the amendment. The first two parts, A and B, had to do with familial relations. Like, it wouldn't be a crime if a non-citizen were to vote if they were adopted and their parents were originally Americans. And then the second element of the amendment was like, it wouldn't be a crime if a non-citizen voted if their parents were Americans and they lived in the country before they were 16,
right.
Which was both kind of screwy, but okay, that's fine. That at least you can, that's based in fact. But then the third piece says that it wouldn't be illegal for a non-citizen to vote if in the election, when they voted, they believed themselves to be citizens.
Yeah,
and it reduced citizenship to a state of mind. Now, it's anybody's guess whether or not, if this is actually tested, which we can't find any evidence that it has been, it's anybody's guess whether or not the courts would determine that all three of those standards had to be met. They don't really clearly connect. At least the third one certainly doesn't. And in an age of where everything is fluid, right, where you can define anything by your state of mind, this does seem to be a loophole intentionally placed, maybe for such a time as this. You know, we didn't get to where we are with our border crisis and the flood of undocumented migrants overnight. This has been inch by inch by inch a rolling storm that has finally come to this crescendo. We'll see how it plays out at the polls, but at the border, you have non-government organizations that are registering non-citizens for all manner of social service programs, and by law, all those social service programs have voter registration applications attached to them. And so we are expecting for everyone to be on their best behavior to make sure that they're not actually registering non-citizens for voting at the same time that they're registering them for HUD housing or health care or food stamps or stipends. And it just, you know, the fact pattern suggests that we do have an awful lot to be concerned about. And that's really what at the heart of the whole Tucker interview, that's the
right.
Heart of it, is the fact pattern suggests that something untoward is afoot.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, I noticed the mainstream media just jumped right on this to help expose it and get the word out about this actual threat to democracy. And, you know, no, of course they did not, but they would have if the 10 to 15 million illegals coming across the border were all saying they'd vote for Trump. But besides Tucker, did any larger media pick this up? Because it seems kind of important.
Not to the best of my knowledge, but I mean, at this point, the reality is Tucker is sort of the top of the hill in terms of viewership. It's better than being on any other network. Mm. You know, my experience with the Fox network of late is just they are so, you know, gun shy about anything related to elections. I haven't been on Fox in years. So, yeah, but the trade-off, and it's a trade-off I'll take any day of the week, is that programs like yours and so many others have wanted to discuss it, and I've been doing, you know, multiple interviews every single day, and the word's getting out, and people are doing their own research and making up their own minds and furthering the stories, and I think that's the best outcome we can hope for is for people to, you know, listen to people that they trust, like you, and then make up their own minds about whether or not this is something that, you know, would seem to be able to garner political advantage for the Biden administration. And it's hard to imagine why else they would be allowing this when Americans, whether they're R's or D's, are clearly against this meltdown at the border. Yes. And the Biden administration is doing nothing about it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so let's take a little bit of a look at the language, and we'll have a link on today's show page on iSpyRadio.com. And today's show page is 14-21. We'll have a link that people can download, a PDF of Title 18 of the U.S. Code, titled Crimes and Criminal Procedure, which is the section that deals with this potential loophole. And it's Chapter 29 of Title 18, Elections and Political Activities. And you want to skip down to Section 611, Voting by Aliens. And subsection C, there is the loophole, and this is the key part. It says subsection A, that's, you know, the part that describes that an alien cannot vote in a federal election. That does not apply if, one, each natural parent of the alien is or was a citizen; two, the alien permanently resided in the United States prior to attaining the age of 16; and three, the alien reasonably believed at the time of voting in violation that he or she was a citizen of the United States. And you know, I'm not an attorney, but I am an editor, so maybe that counts for something here. But as I read those three, that conjunction "and" would seem to indicate all three situations would have to apply for it not to be an illegal vote and for them not to be prosecuted. So you kind of alluded to that. Have you had an attorney officially look at this? Or, I mean, how did they explain that?
Yeah, we have actually had a couple of attorneys look at it, and their feedback to us was that "and" could be interpreted as taking all three together, or "and" could be interpreted as there are three ways, this, and this. Hmm. And, you know, it was presented as in as much with Tucker that this is, you know, this is the current and this is what we know. And let the people decide. It's certainly wouldn't be the first time that we would see a court decide to parse a standard to its own benefit. So, I'm not an attorney. Don't pretend to be, but I do know that the process for registering non-citizens is shockingly lacking in checks and balances. And so even having something like this dangling out there gives me pause.
Yeah, absolutely. I just looked at the clock and we are way past our time. So let's go ahead and take a break. Come on that interview with Tucker Carlson, Catherine Engelbrecht said that we need to get out in front of this. How do we do that? We'll ask her about that next. Catherine Engelbrecht is president of True the Vote, an organization on the front lines protecting the rights of eligible voters. You can find out more about them at truethevote.org. truethevote.org, and among the many things they do, their work focuses on empowering citizens to safeguard the electoral process and to protect their vote from fraud so that their vote is not diminished. And that's really the focus of what we've been talking about here, not diluting legal votes with illegal ones. And so before we get on to how do we get out in front of this, I just want to pick up on something, because that subsection C was added specifically in the year 2000. A and B were added in 1996, from what I understand. Section C, though, was specifically added in 2000. So why add that loophole to begin with? That just, you know, why add a loophole unless you plan on using it?
That's the way it struck me. It also struck me that A and B are fact-based. I mean, it would be a lot to go through somebody's family tree and understand who was whom and when they were living in certain, but you know, that's at least achievable.
Sure.
But reducing citizenship to a state of mind introduces not only a loophole, but a loophole that is completely open to interpretation. How do you rule it? I mean, how do you, what does it mean to believe that, oh yeah, I thought I was a citizen? Well, I mean, what anchoring facts can you demonstrate in that? It just seems to your point, it just seems to be something that would be added only to exploit.
Yeah. And I agree. I suppose we shouldn't be surprised that Bill Clinton was behind that. Moving on, as I mentioned, going on to that segment there, on that interview you had with Tucker Carlson discussing this potential loophole, you said that we need to get out in front of this. So how do we get ahead of this?
Well, a few things, and you can check it out on our website, truthevote.org. We have a project right now called the 611 Project, named after the section of code that kind of started all of this. And we've put together a volume of information for activists' consideration that really talks about how we found ourselves here now, because it's not been overnight. This has been going on since 1993, when the National Voter Registration Act was passed and first codified the standard of attaching voter registrations to social service programs, which is what we're seeing now used at the border. So we lay all of that out, but with that, we put together a call to action. And what we're recommending that people do first is to ask their Secretary of State to publish the process that their state follows for verifying citizenship. Because if they have a process and they can publish it, then we can all sleep a little easier knowing that it's in hand. But I will tell you that True the Vote also posted a open records request to all states in the top 200 counties asking the question ourselves. And the responses we've gotten have been wholly unsatisfying. It doesn't give me any confidence that there's really a solid process in place. And it doesn't shock me because at least as much as we understand, you know, and I don't have perfect knowledge about all the intricacies of each state, but what we do know is that states are given access to a whisper-thin database called the SAVE database to do citizenship checks, and it's a cumbersome process. You almost have to know the answer before you ask the question. It's not something that can be readily done at scale. You have to check one record at a time. It's
good
just
gravy.
Not. Yeah, it's just not. You know, it's just not an appropriate way to go about this.
Because checking one record at a time will. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, you need to be able to take the voter roll, ping it up against a comprehensive database, and come away with citizenship status, you know. And it should be mentioned that in private industry, companies that have need of this kind of information can do these checks in near real time, all day, every day. They can validate identity, residency, and citizenship. So it's not like the data doesn't exist. It's what's lacking is the political will,
right,
to use it. And so the first call to action is ask the states to publish what they're doing, because maybe they have an answer we don't know about. Secondly, if they don't, then demand from your elected that they push for the federal government to give access to the data for the states to be able to do the types of verifications that they should by all rights have as a standard. But if they don't, let's correct that. And that can still be done before the rolls close 90 days out from November's election. That can all still be achieved. This is not a heavy lift. The data exists, the technology exists, but you know, putting the dots together is what's lacking. So that's the second part of the call to action. And then lastly, and it's something that, look, I hope I'm wrong about this, but a card that Biden holds is the possibility of executing an executive order giving amnesty and citizenship to the now some estimated 15 million undocumented migrants that have been allowed into the country and strategically relocated, you know, to states that mattered to the Biden administration. It's sort of a worst case scenario, and I would just shudder to think that it could happen. But there's nothing precluding it. There is precedent for it. President Reagan did it. President Obama did it. And you know, certainly it would be pushed back against in court, but it would cause sufficient confusion at the polls that wouldn't it just be just the right size of confusion to trigger the very loophole we started the interview with?
Yeah,
I think I'm a citizen. I don't know. There's an executive order that says I've been given citizenship. I don't know.
Right.
What do you do with that? And once that vote is cast, you can't separate it. You can't unring the bell. And if the goal is just to cause confusion, which is exactly what we saw in 2020, then they're well on their way to achieving it.
Well, yeah, you know, maybe what we need is a campaign ad. If you help get Trump elected, maybe he won't deport you.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, this is scary stuff. And unfortunately, we are up against the clock. Catherine, I want to thank you so much for your time today and for everything that you guys are doing to get word out about this.
Thanks so much for having me.
And welcome back. We're talking now to Chuck Weiss. He is a scientist, meteorologist, and fearsome global warming debunker. He's also a former commercial airline pilot and has now become a political activist, including working to ensure the integrity of our elections here in Oregon. Chuck, it's great to talk to you again.
Well, glad to be back, Mark.
Yeah. So, you know, it's been a while since we've had you on to talk about your election case that you and Mark Thielman and other plaintiffs had brought. And in fact, I think the last time that we had you on was to talk about that was when it had gone to the Ninth Circuit, where it was denied before heading to the Supreme Court, which has also now turned down the opportunity to hear it. But sum up for our audience what that case was about and what led you guys to bringing it against the Secretary of State to begin with.
Well, Mark, this went all the way back to the 2020 elections, where at that time, a lot of people were suspicious during the presidential election that things were not kosher at all. And some of the people running around in academic circles ran some basic statistical tests on the output of the election data in the 2020 presidential election. And when I looked at all this and what they had done, you could see there were clear statistical fails in how that data was coming out. The Benford distribution test was one important one that I looked at. In fact, I put it up on my Facebook page, and that was a major fail. And what that tells us was that while it doesn't prove that there was malfeasance and fraud by itself in and on its face, it does tell you that there's a huge statistical anomaly that needs to be rectified and looked into. And that's what started the ball rolling with a lot of these looking into cases and starting civil lawsuits all around the country. Ours wasn't the only one, but that started the ball rolling. And then we had an individual here in Oregon by the name of Tim Sipple, and I think you guys talked about that case too, where he wanted to see the database in Washington County. Washington County uses Clear Ballot. That's the name of the company that runs the election systems in Oregon. And he wanted to see what the results looked like for Washington County and had requested to take a look at the database, which was in the computer system that covered and tabulated the elections. And he was told by the county, no, you can't do it. And he appealed his decision to the district attorney's office for Washington County. And Kevin Barton is a district attorney who reversed their decision and allowed it. And no sooner did the did Barton's decision tell Tim Sipple, you can look at this file, that Secretary of State, then Secretary of State Shamia Fagan, who's corrupt, by the way, and had to leave office, but she horned in and said, no, we're not going to let you see it. And soon after that, we had the Attorney General for the state of Oregon, Ellen Rosenblum, file a lawsuit against Mr. Sipple to try to block him from seeing any of this data that he wanted to see.
Yeah,
and that went to trial.
Just to pause you there for a second, all of that really explains why people question the election. You know,
it absolutely does.
You mentioned Benford's Law, which is a statistical analysis tool. Me tweeting about that, that's what got me banned on Twitter. And this notion that you block people from asking questions like Tim Sipple was doing, you know, the truth never minds being questioned. In fact, it welcomes being questioned. And when you start suing people to stop them from asking questions, that's why people distrust the elections.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And my position about this, and that's what actually got my angst up and got me involved in it, because my position is exactly what you stated. If the state officials and election officials in this state or any other state have nothing to hide, and by the way, the elections are not owned by the state. They are owned by the citizens mm-hmm. of these states. Mm-hmm. We, the people, are the ones who get to make sure that our systems are running according to law and according to the way they should, so that our 14th Amendment rights to cast a sacred vote are protected. And so when the state turns around and says, no, you can't see the data, we're not going to let you look at anything, that just makes me think to myself, there's plenty that you people are hiding.
Yeah.
And so unfortunately, the judge in that case, I think it was Janelle Whipper was her name, in Washington County, she voted against Mr. Sipple's counter defense and saying he wants to see this data, and told the state she believed everything they said. And their basic argument was, well, we can't let them look at this because it's proprietary and the trade secrets will be forever let go by clear ballot, and so it'll cause irreparable harm to them and to the state.
Yeah,
this was a ridiculous argument.
It was ridiculous because, and I remember discussing this with, I think it was you and maybe Steve Jonkins, about the fact that they were claiming the database was proprietary. And to me, when I heard that this database was proprietary, that was a huge red flag. Because
if it was
a list of names and addresses and registration status and voting history, then there's nothing proprietary about that at all, because that's information gained from the state, which, again, that's owned by the citizens. Those are state records. But if there's something proprietary in there, then that seems to me to indicate that they have some kind of formulas or algorithms running in there that they would not want to have that exposed.
That's absolutely right, because what we found out was the database that they were protecting is called a SQL database. And that sort of database has formulae in it, it has tables in it, and it has the ability to manipulate and make calculations outside of counting. And a voting machine should do nothing but count the votes. That's all it is supposed to do mm-hmm. if you really want to make sure that it's not subject to all these other errors that can come into play. And it doesn't matter whether they did it deliberately or whether it happens by accident. But what we found out was these machines are not airtight. They're not air-gapped like they claimed that they were. They can log on to the Internet. And, in fact, at the end of that trial, the judge even made the argument for the state that, well, irreparable harm could be done, and it would invite hackers. If they can see what the SQL database looks like and what the calculations are that are done in it, it can be hacked by nefarious players, and therefore votes can be manipulated. Well, if you're going to say it can be hacked by nefarious actors, then you're admitting it's not air-gapped.
Yeah.
It's online.
Right.
And in fact, we found out from MIT scientists and others that some of these other voting systems, including the ones that run that were Diebold machines, they were actually hacked by somebody who made the movie Kill Chain. I don't know if you ever saw that or not.
No.
But this guy was able to hack those machines successfully, and it was all in his movie of how he did it. And of course, all of that's just ignored. They didn't seem to care about it. Nobody did a thing to stop it, and nothing has ever been done to correct all these problems with the machines. And we not only saw him in that movie, but then when we went to Colorado, Secretary of State of Colorado, Tina Peters, did backup files to show that something was really not right with the Colorado election system. And these people in the state of Colorado viciously went after her and prosecuted her when she was simply doing her job. They made up a bunch of bogus charges and went after her. And they seem to be doing this with anybody who is really trying to go after and challenge these election machines and to get them thrown out, which they need to be.
I could certainly understand the type of proprietary formulas that they would want to protect. I mean, if it's in there analyzing the data as it comes in and then projecting winners and how many votes you would need to overcome that margin of victory, I could see that as being proprietary and why they would not want something like that coming out. Okay, it is time for a break. Coming up, the Supreme Court refused to hear their election case. It could have restored some real integrity to Oregon's elections. Why would a court, any court, especially the Supreme Court, not want to hear that? We'll speculate on that next. And welcome back. We're talking with Chuck Weiss. He's a trained scientist, meteorologist, and clear thinker, and he follows politics as closely as anyone in the news media right now. He's also becoming a bit of a political activist and has been involved in a number of lawsuits, well, a couple anyway, to bring some integrity back to our elections. And one of those made it all the way to the Supreme Court, but unfortunately was declined to be heard. So as typical, the Supreme Court does not give reasons why they declined to hear cases. And on the same day, just to give people an example, on the same day they heard chose not to hear yours, there were something like 59 other cases that they also turned down. Has your attorney in that case, Stephen Jonkis, did he speculate to you personally as to why the Supreme Court may have opted not to hear that?
No, he really didn't. In fact, we were optimistic that the Supreme Court would take the case, and it was because of the way it was worded and the strategy that was used that we thought it cleared us of all the other cases that were brought before it, where they were being asked in those other cases to decide election outcomes. Ours wasn't really doing that at all. So no, and the court didn't give us a reason. But this whole thing, as a non-lawyer looking at this, I'm of the belief now that the courts have failed us. They have failed to protect our 14th Amendment right and the sacred right to vote, because in our case, at the beginning level in the U.S. District Court for the state of Oregon in the Portland Division, the judge there denied the case under the similar rulings that Janelle Whipper did in the Tim Sipple case. And then when we appealed it to the Ninth Circuit agreed to hear oral arguments before deciding whether to reverse what was done in the lower court and send it back. And all of a sudden, without any explanation, Mark, they pulled the rug out from underneath us and said, oh, guess what? We changed our mind. We're not going to have an oral argument, and we're going to deny your right to have this reversed, or not your right, but we're going to deny the request by you to reverse this to a lower court. So then that left us with no other choice but to go to the Supreme Court, and it failed there as well. Well, if we don't fix the election system, and there's plenty, plenty wrong with it, and this is not just Republicans, it's not conservatives saying this. Before the 2020 elections, Democrats were screaming bloody murder about a lot of the same things we are screaming bloody murder about now, except after the 2020 election when they managed to steal that from President Trump. And that's my opinion. I think they did steal it from him. Now all of a sudden there's silence on their side. They don't want to hear anything. Oh no, the elections are secure. It's the most secure election in history. We actually heard people coming out and saying that after 2020 when we know that it wasn't. Yeah. And I frankly don't care what part of the political spectrum you're in. If you believe in the democratic republic we're supposed to have and have that system run as it should, it is we the people that are supposed to elect our officials and pass or fail ballots as there are initiatives that are put before us by the legislative and executive branch of government. And if we don't have the sacred right to vote protected and people in it can control and manipulate elections, then we don't have a democratic republic anymore.
Yeah. No, absolutely we are, not. In 2016, they were saying that the election had been stolen. For heaven's sakes, in the next 4 years, Hillary complained about that very thing. But then I think they learned to use the election rules against us, and that's how they stole 2020. But everybody, as you say, everybody should be concerned about this, because if you can't trust the elections, you can't trust the government that was elected by those elections. The other thing is, too, is that once one side learns how to cheat, it's only a matter of time before the other side decides to do the same thing. Yeah, to me, I kind of wonder if one of the reasons why the Supreme Court didn't decide to listen to your case is that maybe it's just not ripe enough yet, because you've got the Republican National Committee and their new leadership. They filed something like 84, I think, election integrity lawsuits. And I think we're still in the process of those, you know, kind of still baking and they're still in the oven, and the Supreme Court's kind of waiting to see what comes to the top on those. I did get a statement from Stephen Jonkis, a text from him. He would not speculate to me either. And he says the primary way to get a petition granted is a circuit court split on a question of law. In other words, the Court of Appeals has different rulings on the same question of law. He did say that your guy's case presented a novel question for which there was no circuit split, but which the Ninth Circuit got the law wrong. And a circuit court getting the law wrong is usually not enough for the Supreme Court to take a case. He also said you have to realize that only 1% of the petitions are ever granted. Everyone thinks that their case is important, but the Supreme Court has to be cutthroat in rejecting petitions because they only handle about 80 to 150 cases in a year. So you can kind of see that. But I'd like to think your case isn't done yet.
Well, I don't. Election integrity is not going to go away just because the courts failed us. We have to do something about this, because if we don't have it's like I said, the courts are supposed to be the check and balance against the executive and legislative branches of government. When they overreach in their boundaries by creating unconstitutional laws, and it's the Constitution, it's that document that the courts are supposed to protect no matter what the legislative or executive branches of government do. And anytime they overreach and step outside those bounds, it's up to the court to say, no, you cannot do this, and yank them back in. And protecting our right to vote, this is where I would disagree with, we get so many cases, we just can only take so many of them. They have to prioritize what they're going to listen to and what they're not going to listen to. And this is an extremely important matter. It needs to be resolved, and they're simply not doing it. And it just makes you wonder what's happening in the country.
Absolutely it does. And actually, let's go ahead and take a break here. Some strange things happen in Blue Oregon primaries, and could there have been some possible cheating? We'll talk about that next with Chuck Weiss. Back. We're wrapping things up now in our final segment. We've been talking about election integrity today, first with Catherine Engelbrecht of True the Vote, and also now with Chuck Weiss, one of Oregon's political activists who is fighting to bring some integrity back to our elections. And speaking of elections, Oregon just had its primary, and the focus is now going to be shifting rather quickly to the general election in November. But one of the more unusual twists in the primary was the sudden dump of ballots in Multnomah County. Usually it's Republicans waiting until the last election day to vote, but this time it happened in very blue Multnomah County. And according to the county spokesperson, on Monday, only 105,000 ballots had been returned, but a staggering 93,600 ballots were dropped off either on Tuesday or mailed Tuesday and Wednesday. And that seems a bit strange. What do you make of that?
Well, this goes right back to what was in our complaint. And when these people, these really foolish, and naive reporters in the media who choose to write about this, they usually call us election deniers. Well, when we filed our case, we had plenty of proof that there was problems with vote by mail. It was one of the things that was in our complaint. And when you have vote by mail, you have the post office that's able to keep track of the ballots coming in that they receive to go to the county after they've been voted and dropped in the mailbox. But they also know from the ballots that they mailed out at the beginning, you know, what the difference is. You know, how many ballots haven't come back and how many ballots do they have up to election day. And so if you're going to cheat one way, you could do it by just knowing the ballots that weren't returned by election day. A nefarious actor can simply take the additional ballots that were from part of an overinflated database of registered voters and vote their ballot for them, either vote for them or just make up one and put it in because of the number of registered voters that they are, and then apply it to that difference. Because back in 2021, the Oregon legislature passed Bill 2681, which now is telling state, we don't have to clean up our voter rolls ever. We can just let them stay dirty. And that's a violation of federal law. But they went ahead and passed it anyway. And now we have more registered voters in the state of Oregon than we do citizens. Now, you can't have that if you're going to have honest elections. Mm-hmm. And this is how they can cheat, by stuffing ballot boxes. So when the post office has a huge accumulation of ballots that all of a sudden they turn into the county later, who knows what's happened to them?
Yeah,
them back.
They've got 500,000 or so registered voters in Multnomah County. So if 105 had been turned in the day before, that was roughly 21%. But then you add another 93,600. That suddenly brings that total up to 40.2%. And it kind of gets back to what we were saying in that last segment, is that when cheating is allowed, when it's tolerated, eventually it's going to come around and bite you personally. And I've always said that Democrats are not going to get behind this until they start bearing the brunt of cheating. And so, not saying that this was cheating, but it sure looks rather suspicious, because normally they turn in all of those ballots, and especially, you know, mail-in ballots. There's really no need to sit on that, but to suddenly almost double that amount from 21% to 40.2%, that's rather suspicious. You know, as far as restoring election integrity legislatively, that seems dead as long as Democrats stay in power. But there is some hope here, because last election in 2022, Republicans nearly retook the House and nearly tied the Senate. And I think the matter of difference was about 8,500 votes. I don't recall that number exactly, but I know it was awfully small and certainly very doable. It really came down to getting the vote out. So as somebody who has dabbled with political activism, what are some of your thoughts on how we might be able to get out the vote better, especially activating those non-affiliated voters?
I'm not really sure what the answer to that is, because there's always a percentage of people in the population that just are not interested in the political system, and they don't seem to care or seem to think that who's ever in power is going to affect their life that much. And you can talk sometimes to these people like you're blue in the face and you won't get them to vote anyway. I think what it really boils down to is you just got to have clean elections, because with the number of ballots that are cast, even if you put those people aside, the number is large enough to where it, you can have a lot of cheating going on with the way the Oregon legislature set this thing up, by not cleaning up voter rolls and then mailing ballots out to a bunch of people who may have died or moved out of state, or just are inactive voters and they don't care to vote in an election even though they might have been registered to vote. Those are all phantom, potential phantom ballots that can be manipulated by people that want to game the system. And as long as that's there, you're going to have a potential problem with this. And then you go into the machines themselves where numbers can be manipulated. And there was examples of this that happened in the 2020 election. And it's the reason why we wanted to look at the clear ballot machines here in Oregon, but the courts were just telling us, no, you can't do it, and didn't get, it just gave us a silly reason why. I mean, imagine if you were a citizen who got something stolen from you. It was under $5,000 of what might be needed to file a criminal charge against the person who did it to you. But let's just say that it was under that and you file a lawsuit against them, and you have pretty good evidence that this person you named in the lawsuit did in fact take this money or things from you that you want to get back. And then imagine the judge looking at that and saying, well, there just isn't quite enough evidence here for me to go forward with the case, and so we're not going to allow it to go forward.
It doesn't make any sense.
The only way you can adjudicate these problems is to have the judges need to stop blocking this stuff and let it go before a jury of our peers. Let the jury decide whether there's wrongdoing and what the remedy should be. Let it go forward. Yeah, and these judges are simply blocking it where none of the evidence ever gets heard.
Yep, that's exactly right. And the time to stop cheating is when it's still small, because when you tolerate it, guess what happens? It'll eventually get big enough to the point where you can't ignore it anymore. Chuck, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Mark, and maybe we can talk more about this in the future, because it's far, far from being resolved.
Yeah, absolutely. I do find it interesting that even here in Oregon, a lot of further left progressive candidates lost to more moderate Democrats. Did fond memories of being able to pay their bills from Trump's presidency spill over into Oregon's elections? Or have even Oregonians had enough of pro-crime Democrats, Bidenomics, and his open borders? There are a few links for you to explore from True the Vote that we'll have up on today's show page. Again, that is 14-21. One is the 611 Project, and the other is a new app they have that can help everyday citizens clean up the voter rolls. I love those kinds of tools that people are putting out there for everyday people to help improve our system and to keep an eye on government. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.